Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
That was so weird. And me, Ali Milani.
Coming up on the show, we will be joined by Henry Hill, Deputy Editor of Conservative Home, to try and make sense of the Conservative Conference. And then we will be joined by the rabbi and co-leader of the new movement for Progressive Judaism, Charlie Baginski, to discuss rising religious violence and anti-Semitism in the UK.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored on social media.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped. So, London late night life is back, with pubs, clubs and restaurants will be able to open into the early hours of as part of London's drive for economic growth. But critics have, of course, poo-pooed this idea, suggesting this will lead to more drunkenly disorder and antisocial behaviour, and I'm sure bring the value down of local residents' houses, which we just couldn't allow to happen. Ali, I obviously have some thoughts on this, as the only one of us who drinks, and I will share them in a second, but I'd like to know what you think of this.
Although I've got to tell you, the Manchester United season has got me dangerously close to starting to drink.
Oh my God.
I mean, first of all, these critics, get a life. What, you know, one of the we've spoken about this before, and I think you're definitely going to touch on it because it's something that you are very, very passionate about, and that's happiness.
And alcohol.
Happiness and alcohol. Our happiness and alcohol expert, Zoe Grunewald. One of the problems the London scene has, and people know I think London is the greatest city in the world. It's the best city I've ever been in, and I'm never going to live anywhere else unless, you know, Nigel Farage decides to deport me to Wembley. One of the problems London has is there is no sort of cafe culture, real sort of nightlife culture in the way that exists in some European cities. So whenever I've gone on holiday to mainland Europe, cafes are open till like 1 a.m. People are sat outside playing cards, having coffee, drinking alcohol, all this sort of stuff. And it leads to more happiness, basically, because you have a social life where you don't have to spend hundreds of pounds to socialize with your friends, to interact, to do sort of social activities. So I think this is a really, really good idea. And you know what? I'm less concerned. This will get clipped up, but I don't really care about the economic growth as much as I care about the happiness element and the vibe that it will bring London. People being able to chill at a pub or chill at a coffee shop at like 1 a.m. in the morning, playing cards or board games or like just chatting, shooting the shit with their friends.
I agree. And I think you're right. And I would agree with this, that we shouldn't see everything through the lens of economic growth, because I think often economic growth is seen as an end rather than a means to actually improving society and people's lives. And it's nice just for once to have a bit of policy that people will look at and think, oh, that actually would be quite good for me, because, you know, maybe I'll be able to see my friends a bit longer and I don't have to worry too much about getting a booking at this restaurant. I can just hang out at this cafe or whatever, those kind of things. There's going to be, obviously, criticisms to this. Firstly, there's going to be the usual NIMBYs who already were the reason that pubs and clubs and restaurants and cafes had to close early, because there are all the noise complaints. You know, they're worried about how late night licensing will affect the price of their property. And they will object thoroughly to this, which is just ridiculous. And one of the reasons we have had such stunted economic growth in this country is because of ridiculous, outdated planning rules that mean councils can just poo-poo projects and businesses being able to keep going until later in the evening. So, you know, that is one thing. The other is public health criticisms about whether this will just mean that people will drink more. So some critics have said that this plan amounts to a charter for chaos that will lead to more drink-related aggression, greater violence against women, and even more deaths from alcohol. I'm just going to make the point that alcohol does not cause men to assault women. Men cause men to assault women. Men will assault women whether or not they have a drink. Men will go home after the pub shuts and drink and do what they do. We need to look at VOG as an issue in itself, violence against women and girls as an issue in itself. Obviously, we want to encourage people to cut down on drinking, but I do think people are getting better at taking health into their own hands. And if people are able to spend time with their loved ones at pubs, at restaurants, at cafes a little bit later, I think that's something we should be aiming for. I think we can look at the public health elements separately, look at how we can discourage drinking, look at how we can come down on violence against women and girls, but I don't think just shutting businesses up at 10 p.m. and saying that's your lot, you can't be trusted, is the way to go.
No, and it doesn't suggest that that's actually working, because that's the current model that we're using, and we still have huge levels of binge drinking. Alcohol is still one of the leading causes of death, both short, medium and long term in the country. So I think what's happening here is people are taking legitimate concerns about public health and they're using it pretty cynically, because they maybe have an alternative problem, which may be cost of properties, for example, et cetera, and using it in this scenario. Because if these people actually cared about public health, then maybe we'd be having a conversation around not just alcohol, but all drug use in our society overall, the level of binge drinking that exists in our society overall. Funnily enough, the people who will use this and bring in the conversation about violence against women and girls don't tend to talk about conviction rates, don't really tend to talk about investigations, don't tend to talk about what we spoke about on the show a couple of weeks ago, which is the risk assessment that police officers are using. So I think it's pretty bad faith to use public health as a reason to like poo-poo this idea. And again, it's not all alcohol that we're talking about here, right? It's things like cafes,
restaurants,
yeah, and just keeping pubs open for not everybody goes into a pub to drink.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
We need separate public health campaigns about people drinking responsibly, and we are seeing, especially amongst newer generations, alcohol consumption decreasing.
That's definitely true. Yeah, people are drinking a lot less. Younger people. Yeah,
it says the Home Office's own analysis has found that alcohol is a factor in half of all intimate partner murders, but I bet you 98% of those, the factor is actually the fact that there are men in those incidents, and I bet you they are violent with or without alcohol.
Yeah, that's what I would
alcohol,
say.
Ruins people's inhibitions, but men aren't violent because they drink. Men are violent because they're violent.
Yeah, and it's I would be really interested, and I would be able to bet a good chunk of money that alcohol being a key factor in that violence, there is a history of violence prior to the alcohol being introduced as a variable. The reality is, look, for me, if you walk through, and a lot of this will be in the centre of London, we're talking about the city, like we're talking about Oxford Street, Piccadilly Circus, Baker Street, that sort of area where there is a lot of housing, but it's very rich housing, which is probably why people are kicking off. But if you walk through Oxford Street, for example, at 10:30, it's pretty dead, and it shouldn't be.
No.
We're talking about one of the largest, most metropolitan cities in the world. And if this show finished, for example, at 9:10 p.m. and me, you and the producers wanted to go hang out and grab a couple of drinks until midnight, 1 a.m, we wouldn't be able to find a place.
No. I mean, I'm going to the theatre next week, and I was hoping I could go find somewhere for dinner afterwards, finish at 10:30.
Yeah.
No. it's ridiculous. London is supposed to be a 24-hour city. So
we didn't get an invite to the theatre. Who did you get? Producers, do we get an invite to the theatre?
Is it your 30th birthday? Am I buying you a 30th birthday present?
I wish I was 30.
Maybe next time.
I wish I was 30.
Okay.
What are you going to watch, by the way?
The Devil Wears Prada, the musical.
Ah, very nice.
I'll let you know. My hopes are sort of medium high. Okay, let's move on to Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage has made £1 million since the general election, having declared his income for the first time since May. Ali, you're a politician. Are you making £1 million in second jobs?
Didn't want to admit this on air, but I was invited to give an after-dinner speech where I was paid £250,000. No, I've never been invited to give an after-dinner speech, nor have I made £1 million. But we've spoken about this before, right? It's an eye-watering amount of money to be receiving as a second job. And I would gently ask viewers, supporters of Farage and opponents of Farage, he gets paid, what, £90,000+ to be an MP and £1 million in his second jobs. Logically, which one do you think he prioritises?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise, is it? If you are at GB
News... I mean, £1 million is more than I thought, by the way.
Yeah.
Right?
If you're at GB News and you're earning £511,000. He's also a brand man of the people. Nigel Farage is a brand ambassador for Direct Bullion, which is a gold bullion company, making £281,000. Oh, and he's doing videos for Cameo, which is
£171,000 on Cameo.
Yeah.
Do you think we should do Cameo?
I'm well. I just can't believe. I mean, I can see why you'd. I mean, it's a great thing, isn't it? Because people who don't like him will get him to do cameos because they'll want to send it to like parents or friends who hate him to wind them up. You know,
doing one for your birthday, though.
Don't pay him any more money.
No, I'm going to.
No,
it's going to be really funny. He's going to plug.
I'll
politics
be cross.
And I look. By the way, this story, I think, perfectly encapsulates what a charlatan this man is who presents himself as this anti-establishment political figure. Because, first of all, Reform and Nigel Farage consistently complain of this idea of a liberal media. They'll attack Channel 4 News, they'll attack BBC News and talk about how the mainstream established media don't give Reform a fair shot. First of all, Reform get some of the largest coverage of any political party, including those in government, anywhere. He's the only political party leader that I know that has his own show on media, right? He hosts his own show on a mainstream media program, GB News.
Which is basically a Reform party propaganda outlet.
Yeah, but it's party political broadcasting for Reform 20. 24/7 pretty much. That's my allegation anyway. And makes £500,000 apparently from it, by the way. The man who is supposed to be anti-establishment and a champion for working class people, you said, earns how much? £280,000 from Direct Bullion
for a gold company
who I'd never heard of, and then earns another £170,000 doing weird videos for people who most of the time are trying to make him look like a fool, and he doesn't catch on to it. So this idea that he's anti-establishment or the media are out to get him is such utter bullshit.
And I think there is a real conflict of interest here because, and I don't, it is amazing to me that Ofcom are not acting on this. He is being paid £500,000 for GB News. GB News's interest is in, it will say, holding the government to account. But really, as we know, it is a far-right mouthpiece. It espouses some of the worst views about immigration, about how the government's doing, about freedom of speech, etc., etc. It is just completely... its aim is seemingly to just...
It's pound shop Fox News.
Yeah, to pour shit on the UK. Nigel Farage is supposed to be an MP first and foremost. He's supposed to be doing his bit for the country. How is it not a conflict of interest that he's also working for a TV channel that just wants to bring the worst kind of news and the worst opinions to the British public? I think it's extraordinary that you can have an MP doing this, presenting the news. It seems to me like such a massive conflict of interest.
I mean, there's also a question about how can he possibly find the time to do all of this? Because... you know, I work with quite a few MPs and a lot of them don't have enough time in the day to respond to parliamentary stuff, to respond to casework that they're getting back in the constituency. So most of them don't have enough time in the day to do their parliamentary gig. But this guy finds time to host a show on GB News, be a brand ambassador for a gold company and do videos on Cameo, all while being a party leader and a member of parliament. And
scrutinising legislation, representing his constituents' interests in Clacton, going to his constituent surgeries. He's also the leader of the political party with five MPs. You're right. How do you juggle all of that with your show? Is it 3 days a week on GB News? Your whatever it is that you have to do for gold, apparently, and your little stupid videos for members of the public who hate or like you.
And I guess this becomes a point. We had this we had a long debate in Uxbridge, but even before I was a candidate, because when Boris Johnson was our MP, he used to write this op-ed for The Telegraph, I think. He had a regular weekly op-ed that he got paid something like £250,000 for. But it was behind a paywall. And we tried to actually complain to both Ofcom and I think Parliamentary Standards that it should not be allowed that I have to pay to access the views of my MP who I've elected, right? The opinions and political views of my member of parliament, my constituency MP, shouldn't be behind a paywall for me as a constituent. And I think the same question should be applied to not just Nigel Farage, but every MP in their second job about if you've been elected into parliament, it is a wonderful honour. You get to represent your communities. You get paid a shit ton of money, by the way. £92,000 is way more than what I would say 80-90% of the country get paid annually. No one should be allowed to have a second job. That should be your absolute number one priority, 24/7 in terms of your 24/7 of your work life. Obviously not 24/7 because you're still a human being. Because what I'm seeing here is the second highest earner for second jobs is from the Labour Party, Chris Bryant. with £120,000. So none of this should be allowed. And I think the questions constituents will rightly ask themselves is, you know, which one are they prioritising? Mm. Will it be the £90,000 job in Parliament, or will it be the £500,000 for GB News? Mm. Do you think we should ban all second jobs?
I do. And I think we should pay MPs more.
Do you think?
Yeah, so they don't need to take on second jobs.
What, just ban them and pay them the same amount, no?
I think you should pay them a little bit more. I think you should expect higher standards from them and pay them a little bit more. It's a huge job. It's a massive responsibility. But absolutely, yeah, ban second jobs. They also shouldn't be landlords. You know how I feel about that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But a lot of this is conflicts of interest. That's what I'm saying. Like, I guess that's principally the problem, right? If you're legislating on the behaviours and laws around landlordism, for example, and owning property, and you're also a landlord, or if you're legislating on gold, and you happen to be a brand investor for gold, and you're getting paid.
It's always a conflict. It's always a conflict of interest. And I would also say the more you pay them. Like, for example, I think it's in Singapore they pay them a lot. Mm. You expect higher standards, and it makes them less corruptible because you pay them more.
Yeah, I mean that was definitely one of the ways that developing countries that had problems with corruption in the police. Mm. That's one of the principal ways that they fixed that was paying police more so they weren't corrupt as corruptible. Yeah,
yeah. Maybe we'll come back to that. It's an interesting debate to have. Let's move on, because this is a huge piece of news that's unfolding pretty much as we speak. A ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas have been announced after intense negotiations in Egypt. These have been, I think, a couple of weeks in the making now. Mm-hmm. Ali, how much of a landmark moment is this?
So we've got to be really, really careful. The ceasefire is enormously important because it stops, at least I think, the immediate fighting.
Can you just take us through the details of the deal and then tell us what you think?
Okay, so what seems to have happened is that a deal has been struck by Israel and Hamas in Egypt with the supervision of America that would bring the immediate fighting to an end in Gaza, at least temporarily. It's a multi-phased plan. Only phase one has been agreed to so far. So phase two and three haven't been agreed to so far, but phase one has. And what phase one says is Israel will pull back its forces into the east, away from the really densely populated areas like Gaza City and other places, and will pull back to an agreed upon line nearer to the Israeli-Gaza border. And in return, the Hamas will release all of the hostages, including what we believe to be around 20 that are still alive. Israel will allow more aid to go into Gaza, and in exchange for the hostages, I believe some Palestinian prisoners / hostages will also be returned as well. And that's phase one of the plan, in essence. We've seen loads of pictures of celebrations in Gaza, because what this largely means is that the sort of slaughter and bloodshed of Palestinians in the immediacy will stop. And in exchange, the hostages in full will be released. There's been a lot of pressure on Hamas by outside forces, the US, for example, Qatar, Turkey, and others. Phase two and three are still in draft form, so they've not been agreed, but they'll include things like a six-week ceasefire and any peace plan deals. But it's hugely significant, as it will probably see the most intense, immediate levels of fighting come to an end.
Brilliant. Thank you. We'll come back to this in the show in following weeks, I'm sure. But that is it for now, for the Week Unwrapped. And coming up after the break, we're going to be speaking to Deputy Editor of Conservative Home, Henry Hill, about the Tory conference. Stay tuned.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you'd never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly, I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way from this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction, send them financial content that you like. If you have a favourite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
What the Hell with Georges Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
I'm joined by Alex Mitten, retreat host and mentor.
I think a lot of people are lonely, surrounded by people at the minute. Like, you know, especially living in London, there's fucking people everywhere. But we sort of live these quite strange lives now where we're quite closed down emotionally, you know, even just like with our voice, we don't really speak that often sometimes, do you know what I mean?
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
And joining us now, it's going to be Henry Hill, Deputy Editor of Conservative Home, to chat all things Tory conference. Henry, thank you so much for joining us. Were you one of the few people at Tory conference this year?
Yeah, I was. I realised at one point that it was my 17th consecutive one, which was quite a soul-destroying moment.
That is. I mean, and how did it rank on the list of 17?
Well, I mean, the first one was in Manchester the year in 2009. So that was the year before they went in. So that provided a kind of brilliant, because this was when I was in Manchester. That provided a wonderful kind of contrast, because then, of course, everyone was full of energy and anticipation. The expectation then was that they were going to win the election outright, of course, and not that they'd end up in coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And then this one was smaller, and it wasn't quite as bleak as I think some conferences have been reading historically, especially, you know, in the history of the Labour Party. But I think that's just because fewer things happen at conferences now. You know, you read about the really awful conferences in ages past, and it was because things were actually taking place and being decided at conferences. Whereas these days, conferences tend to be media showcases and corporate networking events and not much else. So it wasn't as bleak as it perhaps could have been, but it was definitely deflated and it was definitely much smaller. And it didn't have that sort of slight cartoon character running on air who hasn't realised the cliff disappeared element that last year's conference had.
Okay, well, better you than me. We're going to talk quickly about Robert Jenrick, who pretty much stole the show at conference, namely because The Guardian reported that he said that areas in the UK are like India and Pakistan and that he saw no white faces in Birmingham, and he has since stood by and defended these comments. We're just going to play the audio for you now.
You know, I went to Handsworth in Birmingham the other day to do a video on litter, and it was absolutely appalling. It's as close as I've come to a slum in this country. But the other thing that I noticed there was that it was one of the worst integrated places that I've ever been to. In fact, in the hour and a half that I was filming with news there, I didn't see another white face. And that's not the kind of country I want to live in. I want to live in a country where people are properly integrated. It's not about the colour of your skin or your faith. Of course it isn't. But I want people to be living alongside each other, not parallel lives. That's not the right way we want to live as a country.
Henry, how did these comments go down? They were obviously reported by The Guardian on the same day as Jenrick's speech, which was seen as the sort of speech to rival Kemi Badenoch. In terms of how the Tory party is being received now, what has this done for Jenrick?
I think the remarkable thing about this, you know, if you think about it compared to a few years ago, is that it hasn't really done anything. The fallout, the main story coming out of the conference is still Kemi Badenoch's final speech and her pledges on things like stamp duty. There hasn't been massive, endless, you know, days and days and days of coverage and of splits. And that's especially remarkable when you think about the fact that of all the people who said it was Robert Jenrick, and if there's one thing that we journalists love, it's being able to play up stories of splits and interpersonal drama and all the rest of it. So I don't think it really did steal the spotlight at the conference. I think overall, Jenrick was to play it quite low key. He'd seen the week before what happened when Andy Burnham rolled up to the Labour conference looking a bit too enthusiastic about being the heir apparent, got everybody's backs up. Team Jenrick are playing everything quite cool, and so there wasn't all that much. Surprisingly, I don't think this has had much of any effect. Now, there can be various reasons for that. Partly, it has to be said, it's just that the Conservatives are bumping along at 17% in the polls. So it's quite hard for any story about the Conservatives to get too much traction when they're sometimes fourth in the party ranking order, sometimes third. But also, I think it represents maybe a shift in not public attitudes, but maybe press expectations, partly driven by reform, partly driven by the increased salience around immigration.
Henry, I want to ask you about reform, because my view of this is that there is no way that Robert Jenrick said this in a private moment and got caught. You don't go to a dinner at party conference and not expect yourself to get recorded. So my view is that this came out on purpose, and the messaging that he used was very much deliberate. How much do you think saying something like, we saw no white faces, areas looked like India and Pakistan, and the association of no white faces with the littering and the slum comments, how much of that is in the context of reform, the Unite the Kingdom rally, the calls for the eradication of Islam from a main stage and 150,000 people cheering? How much of Tory messaging is now being dictated to and danced to the tune of reform?
My personal view is that it's often a mistake that journalists love to make to assume that everyone's playing 4D chess, and that it's actually very rarely the case.
This is very 1D chess, isn't it? Like,
I'm not sure. I don't know either way, but I'm not necessarily sure I agree with you. I think there is a danger when we talk about reform dictating X or Y, because there's a reason that reform, and prior to that UKIP, got big in the first place, which is they tapped into something that a substantial numbers of voters cared about and that the big parties didn't do anything with. Now, I think that's lamentable. I actually really like a two-party system or a two-and-a-bit party system as we used to have. But an essential part of the way that that sort of system works is that the two big parties shift around to make sure that there is never enough space on their outward flank for another party to gain critical mass. And I think that one of the Conservative, maybe the Conservative Party's historic failure over the past 14 years, maybe a bit longer, is that they have stuck their heads in the sand and allowed first UKIP and then reform to own an issue which, whether they wanted to engage with it or not, the public clearly cared about enough. Because if you get a minor party that latches onto an issue that nobody cares about, it just remains a tiny party, right? And so the Conservative Party, yes, they do have to adapt to reform. I actually think the reform at the next election probably are going to be tilting more at Labour than anyone or many people currently seem to realise, because reform came second in 90-something seats at the general election. All but 9 of those are held by Labour. Labour is in government and becoming unpopular the way governments do. And you've already seen Farage starting to tack left on things like spending. But I think that it is a mistake to view any effort by either of the big parties to talk about immigration or integration or whatever else it is as pandering to Reform are currently leading in the polls, right? It would be absolutely insane for either of the two parties to try and ignore an issue which has pushed a party to first place in the opinion
polls. But look,
polls.
Henry, there's a difference between ignoring an issue like immigration and even a conversation around integration, and then the kind of comments that Robert Jenrick has said here, who, with the greatest respect, I would expect to come out the mouth of Tommy Robinson.
Look, would I have said what Robert Jenrick said? No, sure. But I think that if you look at the census data, you do have sometimes quite extraordinary levels of ethnic segregation in parts of our inner cities. You know, you have one area that's heavily Jewish, another area that's heavily Muslim, for example. And that is not purely an integration problem. Obviously, white flight is a part of that as well, and there's an awful lot of very complicated dynamics there. But again, I do think that is something which the public online age, when this information can disseminate without having to go through the newspapers or television, that is something about which the public is aware and about which efforts to sort of tone police it out of the conversation are going to fail. Now, do I think that the Conservatives need to get much better and more sensitive at how they approach these topics? Absolutely, because you're right. It is possible for the parties to engage with these subjects in a way which really only really offers succor and validation to parties of the hard right. And on top of all the moral and ethical questions about that, that's tactically and strategically unwise, because guess what? You are never going to beat them at that game, right? They're always going to be tougher than you, or however you want to phrase it. But on the flip side, I think that sometimes, you know, and some more traditional politicians and politicians from the Cameron era and before are uncomfortable talking about these issues at all. And that can create a problem where the fact that these subjects are broached in this way is shut down. And ultimately, while I understand the reflex, I think that is exactly how we end up ceding all of this space to, you know, your Tommy Robinsons, and I don't put them in the same bracket, but, you know, your Nigel Farages and everything else. So it's a very tricky one for mainstream
Henry,
politicians.
To be honest, I think you're right. Like, we can't just cede the space. I think you're right. But there also has to be a level of responsibility, doesn't there?
I just want to ask you before you go, because obviously the rabbit out of the hat announcement from Badenoch was the abolishment of stamp duty. Can you just kind of quickly tell us, do you think, how are you responding to this? How are the Tories responding to this? Is this a good thing for her to bring out?
I mean, my main reaction to it was, because it's a really good policy, stamp duty is like Britain's least popular tax with economists and anyone who understands its impact, is why on earth didn't the Tories do this before the election instead of doing that more expensive stamp duty cut, which nobody noticed, right? Mm. Like, stamp duty, it was really jacked up. It used to be a really nominal tax. It was jacked up by George Osborne, turned into a revenue tax. It gums up the housing market. It stopped people downsizing, which means that you've got sort of older people in big family homes they don't need, but they don't want to sell it. Understandably, because they don't want to hand tens of thousands of pounds to the tax man. It's a really good policy, and I think it's good that the Tories did something that was big but realistic, because when you're in opposition, especially when you're really struggling, the temptation is always there to come out with something absolutely insane, right? Like, you know, my favourite example is when Gladstone in his final general election campaign promised to abolish income tax. Now, you know, I'm a die-in-the-wool Tory, but I'd have voted Liberal at that election, but he didn't win it, and he knew he wouldn't win it. So I think that given that the Conservatives still lead with the public incredibly on economic responsibility, the fact that they've come up with something that's in that sweet spot of substantial, credible, but also realistic, speaks well to the judgment of the party's policy.
All right, brilliant. Henry, thank you so much for joining us. That was Henry Hill, Deputy Editor of Conservative Home. After the break, we're going to be speaking to the co-leader of the new movement for progressive Judaism, Rabbi Charlie, to discuss rising anti-Semitism and violence in the UK.
Fubar Radio.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? So said it the night we met.
Yeah. Right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, that was the day I made you my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I said I love you, and you were like, I love you too. And I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much, oh my God, I love you.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay, on paper, my type has to have a good soul, good purpose and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I want to find happiness and I need him to be kind.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
And joining us now is Rabbi Charlie. She's a rabbi and the co-leader of the new movement for progressive Judaism. Rabbi Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today. Obviously, we are talking in the wake of a tragic attack on the Jewish community in Manchester. Can you tell me, in the wake of what happened last week, what are you hearing most from your synagogue members now?
I think people are still processing what happened on that day. I'm not sure if your listeners realise that it happened on Yom Kippur, which is the holiest of holy days in the Jewish calendar. And all ritual moments have this structure in the year calendar that you go through. And so something kind of disrupting that was so violent, that so shook people, that I think people are still in that moment in many, many ways of processing it. There's obviously a huge wave of increased security outside buildings. So that's still also very present for people as they continue to enter synagogues. We're still in this festival period, which is supposed to be a period full of joy and lots of attending of community events. And yet people are still really in the midst of that attack in Manchester.
Rabbi Charlie, I wonder if I can ask you about where the country is. I live very close to a Jewish school, and I saw the increased security presence and thought, you know, what must the children be thinking going to school? And then on Friday, when I went to the mosque following a mosque burning attack, we also had increased security at the mosque. It feels like the country is on a real edge, and a moment like this unfortunately felt coming with the rise of religiously discriminatory violence. Can you talk to us about how you feel what state the country is in?
So I think, first of all, we could probably spend the next several days in a conversation about that. I think many of us have felt the really increased of polarization, the inability to have conversations, not only about what's happening in Israel, in Gaza, in the West Bank, but also what's happening on our streets. It's very difficult to find words to have civilized conversation that leads somewhere. We felt the rising polarization and the way that religion and any societal differences have become used as means to separate people rather than as means to bring people together. And it's not something that's going to be answered in sound bites. And I think in your question, there's quite a lot to unpick. I think, first of all, it's important to recognize that not only synagogues, but particularly synagogues, security is an everyday occurrence. Mm. In order to go to anything at a synagogue, you have to go through security. Many of us also, it's not professional security, it's community members. Mm-hmm. We all take our turns on security. So it's really a part of our everyday religious existence. And the idea that that's translating into mosques makes many of us really sad, because nobody wants their children to walk through security in order to go into something that should be a really positive and an addition to their identity in life. And so I think that while you're absolutely right, there is this huge polarization and an additional feel of fear, there's also a kind of crack in that, a crack that maybe the light gets through, which is, I have heard from so many Muslim colleagues, from so many Muslim friends after that attack in Manchester, to check in, to see how I am, to see how it's impacted on our communities, but also how it is for my children, for my family. And the other way, the second that many of my communities saw what happened in Peacehaven and then following attacks in Birmingham, we have absolutely also reached out. And it's meant that many of us are taking an allyship in saying, this is not the country that we want to live in, one that seeks division rather than unity, one that wants our children to grow up in a UK that embraces the diversity and sees that as an asset and what we can learn from each other. And I'm really holding on to that at the moment.
Can we build on that a little bit? Because I think it's important to talk about. Following the Manchester attack, the Friday prayer at my mosque dedicated the sermon that day to sort of solidarity with the Jewish community and why acts like that are completely contrary to the teachings of Islam. Sure. Similarly, after the mosque got burnt down, I know Jewish organizations and faith groups reached out to our mosques and Muslim communities and condemning it, equally condemning people like Tommy Robinson who were invited to Israel. Because I feel very strongly about this as a Muslim who grew up in an area that had a high Jewish population, it often feels like our communities are played against each other. How much of that do we all have a responsibility to tackle, both Muslims, Jews, and the country as a whole, to stop this? It feels often like a Muslim versus Jewish narrative that exists in society, given, by the way, all records show spikes in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia happen at the same time, consistently.
Yeah. What you've just said is completely rational. The problem is when people are scared and when people are emotional, they don't act from a place of reason. That you're absolutely is our responsibility is to try and to calm things in a way that people can hear the other and to understand that somebody else's pain does not diminish our own. And look, the right are no friends of the far right and no friends of any minority. But people find strange bedfellows when they are scared and when they are fearful. And we have to model what it means as leaders in religious communities, just as the sermon was given over to in the mosque, leadership has to step into that position and model what it means to not allow other people to define what division looks like, but rather to provide other models. And we also have to recognize that people are scared and people are fearful, and we have to acknowledge that pain and hold it for them, but allow them other outlets to put that fear and pain in rather than against somebody else.
Following the attack, from across the world, obviously, there were people sending their condolences and obviously condemning the actions of the attacker. And there were some from the domestic Jewish community, but also Israeli representatives who were actually condemning Keir Starmer specifically and the government, and suggesting that some of the actions Keir Starmer had taken in recent months had either endangered the Jewish community or had emboldened extremists. And I think the assumption was that potentially this was to do with the some of the criticisms were to do with the recognition of the Palestinian state. Do you see any correlation there? Is that a fair analysis, or do you think that is it is unhelpful or unfair to criticise or place the blame at the altar of Keir Starmer?
I'm not sure anybody's putting an altar at Keir Starmer.
Sorry, the feet of Keir Starmer.
I understand what you mean. Again, I don't think that there's a simple answer. And I think what is sure is that the attack in Manchester, there's no direct correlation with the recognition of a Palestinian state just because of timing, simply. And I don't think that extremism emerges from one incident, but rather a build-up. I also think that we have to separate what's intention and what's impact. There is no question that there are many, many people on the streets protesting about the actions in Gaza and the devastation and hunger and need to get aid in, who come absolutely from a position of wanting to raise up the voices of those Palestinians. And there have been instances of anti-Semitism as well on those demonstrations. And there is a difference between being on a protest in central London, and when a protest starts outside a synagogue or starts at a time that Jews are going to prayer. There's a difference between somebody talking in a school about free Palestine to somebody who shouts it at my child just because they happen to be Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I think these are all complexities that we try and reduce to very simplistic answers. The impact of there being demonstrations every Saturday where many Jews are on their way to synagogue walking through has an impact, even if that's not the intention of the demonstrators. And piled on top of that, to see anti-Semitic placards on these demonstrations has made many people feel that there is a rise in, and we've seen it, that there is a rise in anti-Semitism. The idea with, I think there was a very poor articulation by the government about what Palestinian recognition meant and what was the pathway underneath it that was going to lead to peace. In the last 24 hours, we've seen this real glimmer of hope of a peace plan. And I think if it had been framed in that rather than what many in the Jewish community saw as being simply recognition without any infrastructure underneath it, has led to lots of correlations being made in what is not a simple situation, but people try and reduce to very simple binaries. And as I said before, I think that in a moment of fear and pain, people want there to be a really easy answer for it. And we know with thinking that there is not an easy answer at all.
I just wanted to ask, you spoke about anti-Semitism on these marches. How much of this do you think is an education issue as well? Because, I mean, I look at my social media and I see really anti-Semitic conspiracy theories just swirling around on my TikTok, for example. But I think a lot of people don't necessarily see, or I think anti-Semitism can be quite insidious, and I think people don't really realise what they're looking at is an anti-Semitic trope. Do you think there is an education issue here, that actually there is a generation of people growing up without really understanding how anti-Semitism often manifests?
I mean, there is a simple answer to that, and the simple answer is yes. Mm. I also think our education system has been completely at fault with that. I think we have we have some wonderful religious studies teachers in the UK, but we don't have enough of them. We don't have, there are lots of moves now to expand our religious education. But when Judaism is taught in school through the lens of Israel and Palestine and through the Holocaust, one is not giving an idea of the breadth of what Judaism is, of the complexity, of the diversity. Like, thank goodness for you having on a female rabbi, somebody from the progressive movement, to really give both face and voice to the fact that we're a really diverse community.
And I think it is really hard. Like, it's really hard for me, who's somebody very engaged in Jewish life, very engaged in Israeli politics and what is happening in Gaza and the West Bank, to understand all the complexities of it. The idea that somebody through a social media lens is going to understand the diversity and breadth of Judaism, the diversity and breadth of Middle East politics, is a lot to ask. And we have to do better. We have to do better at education. We have to do better at how do we talk to each other? How do we not reduce things to TikTok videos, but actually to a complexity of language, and give space to ask questions?
I've got to say, I think that's really, really important. One of the things I've been most frustrated with as a sort of Muslim commentator that exists in the political space is the really, really atrocious religious literacy that exists in this country. And it just means that people, and I think Zoe's right, can fall into the trap very easily of believing conspiracy theories about Jews, about Muslims on social media, because they have such a lack of understanding, basic literacy of the religions, that it's easy to believe some of these things. I just want to ask you one last question from me, because I've had this happen to me, right? You were recently at a rally outside 10 Downing Street alongside Rabbi Josh Levy, where you spoke about the suffering in Gaza. You spoke about Palestinian recognition, which you've mentioned today as well, and were consequently or concurrently, I don't know which one, booed on the stage. As I say, it's happened to me before, so I definitely empathize with you. Can you talk to us about that in general, not just how you felt, but how does that reflect the moment we're in?
Look, it was really painful. I'm not going to try and pretend it was anything else. But I think it takes us back to where we started, which people are in pain, and sometimes their wounds are really raw, and they find it very, very difficult to be able to talk in, to hear things in a moment that feels like it's a moment for something else, or to hold their own pain. I'm less focused, I have to say, about staying in that moment, but actually what happened next, which was that we had a huge outpouring from across the community, even from people who disagreed with us, to say that actually one of the things they treasure about Judaism is the ability to hold multiple truths and to hear different voices. And we had a different cross-communal event last weekend. And actually, you could really see that people were making such an effort to hold each other's voices, to express the diversity of voices. And maybe I'm the eternal optimist and always looking for, you know, we have to. I don't know what else we have, you, me, any of us, but to kind of look for the light. And I really do. I think that in that pain of that moment, both for me personally, but I think in many ways for our community, we've grown. And we've said, actually, this is not what we want to be known for. We want to be known for that we can hold diversity and we can hold different voices. And I think they've really tried to model that in the events that have followed.
And I find that particularly challenging. Again, it goes to religious literacy, is that often if you switch on, you know, it's not even left, right, center. Most mainstream news channels will speak, and media will speak, about Jews and Muslims as homogenous groups, right? Sure. And there is such a breadth of both ideas about how to practice the religion, but also politics. And I think surely that has to be encouraged, that there is a diversity of thought. Look, there's a huge amount of Muslims I disagree with, by the way, and as I'm sure it will exist in the Jewish community. But shutting that down and presenting groups as homogenous is really dangerous.
It's really dangerous, and it's what's happened in time and memorial, and we have to stick in it, and we have to change. Yeah, I know as a woman, for example, that we're often presented as a homogenous species, and people have not wanted to let women have voice and vote even, because there's a wanting to hold on to power. And the same thing happens in religious spaces, that actually there isn't always a willingness to show the diversity and the multiplicity of voices, because actually authority wants to hold on to authority. Power doesn't naturally subvert power. And there's a real allyship. I mean, we work beautifully with many Muslim colleagues in really amplifying that diversity of voices. And I think that there's a real responsibility on government and on to invest in religious literacy, because actually the role of faith in society is vital. But the role of faith doesn't only look like
we have to use the word religious, right? We have to own that word. I am a religious Jew and not allow that to belong to just one part of our community. Similarly, Muslims need to own the word as well, so that we break open and not abdicate from that space and continue to stand up and to continue to give voice to that.
Rabbi Charlie, one final thought from you before we wrap up. This has been really interesting, so thank you so much for joining us. What can we do? And I want to talk specifically about kind of me and Ali, for example, as people who have a platform, you know, are part of the media. What can we do to actually help your cause, help eliminate anti-Semitism, help encourage tolerance and the understanding of different religious groupings? What is the one thing you would like to see more of us doing?
Keep having different voices on. I would absolutely say don't allow narrative to be reduced to the binary. We're in the age of fluid identities. Let's have the same spirit of fluidity in language. Let's ask questions. And I think let's challenge. Let's not be afraid to challenge something, to ask the question. Is this anti-Semitic? Is this anti-Muslim hatred? You know, let's ask those questions and explore what that means. Mm. And I think give voice to it. Don't be afraid of not stepping into the space of talking about religion, because it's really at the heart of so much of the conversation in modern society, but we're a bit afraid of it.
Rabbi Charlie, thank you so much. That was great. Thank you. I'm afraid that is all we've got time for today. That's it from Politics Uncensored. It's been another interesting week with lots and lots going on. Join us again next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we're going to unwrap the week's political talking points.
You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani Live.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBAR Radio or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.